I'm Pastor Morris Wee, Parish Pastor in Northfield, Minnesota. I've been doing the Bible studies last week and this week. Last week, the story of Joseph, and we read through that whole thing. And this week, the stories of four women, Tamar, Rahab, the wife of Uriah, and Ruth. And I will read to you now the beginning of the Gospel of Matthew, which provides the rationale for studying these four women. Before I do that, I should plug a book that I asked to be put in the bookstore. And it's not connected directly to these texts, though in some ways, since there's violence every place you turn in the Bible, it may be. It's a collection of sermons that are addressed to themes of violence, both domestic violence, violence against the environment, war. And it's called The Design of God's Great Love, Overcoming the Violence in Our Lives. It's in the bookstore. It's got a red cover. It's on the table of recommendations by the pastors and or by the presenters. It just came out the week before I came out, and I've got a sermon in it. So I thought, well, I can plug something that I did. The forum tonight, incidentally, that has been generated by themes of the teaching staff in the village this week is about violence and the roots of violence in our society. That's at 9 o'clock tonight. And it'll be a panel of a couple of the teaching staff members, and your participation is encouraged in that forum, too.
Maury, can I just put in a book? The storytelling session today, too, is entitled "A Brer Possum's Dilemma," and it's also peace stories, stories about peace and reconciliation. So,
good.
A lot of things are coming together today.
Yeah, good. Thanks, David. Yeah. Well, there's not a lot of peace and reconciliation in these. It's the other side of things that we're going to see. Palace intrigue is what we get quite a bit of with the wife of Uriah. Let me read you the genealogy I mentioned. The beginning of the Gospel of Matthew, the kind of thing that we all skip over and get to the real stuff. It's a long genealogy, 42 generations. An account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. First break in the pattern here. You get the "and his brothers" in here. Not relevant strictly to the genealogy of going from father to son to son to son, but relevant because the story of Judah and his brothers, Joseph and all those 12, was so important to these people that they include it. And Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, mentions the twins, even though only one of them is relevant to the genealogy, by Tamar, first woman mentioned. Perez, the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Aram, Aram, the father of Amminadab, Amminadab, the father of Nahshon, Nahshon, the father of Solomon, Solomon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab, and Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth, and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. The genealogy goes on at length. There are four women mentioned in this whole genealogy. Now, the wives and the mothers of these men are known in many, many cases. Why weren't they all mentioned? There are many cases in which the men had multiple wives. So it's not merely to determine which of their wives was the mother. There's some other reason. And that's one of the themes of the week, one of the questions of the week. What is there about this woman, the wife of Uriah, Tamar and Rahab and Ruth, that is so distinctive or so important that Matthew chooses to single them out? There are maybe women we even know more about than these that might have been included in here. Sarah, you know, Rebecca. But no, they're not. They're not here. Just these four. So this is one of them. There's quite a bit of material in here. And Bathsheba, which is the name of the wife of Uriah, figures as a very minor character in this first reading. You will hear how it seems to be primarily about David. But the stories are such great stories, I want us to read right through them anyway. So we will read that and then the later stories in which she figures more significantly, or at least with a more apparently major part. So, starting at the beginning of chapter 11, our readers. I will try to explain who all these characters are as we go. I may break off the reading a little bit to explain, because it's quite a bit of material for you to take up all at once. David is the king, and there's constant fighting taking place here. All right, could you start now, whoever volunteered to narrate at the beginning of chapter 11?
In the spring of the year, the time when kings go forth to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him in all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking upon the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said,
"This is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite."
So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David,
"I am with child."
So David sent word to Joab.
David? Do we have a David?
Yes. Okay. "Send me Uriah the Hittite."
And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing, and how the people fared, and how the war prospered. Then David said to Uriah,
"Go on home and rest a while."
Oops, I lost my voice.
Eight.
What number?
Middle of eight.
Eight.
Middle of eight.
Middle of eight. Then David sent to Uriah. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. When they told David,
Uriah did not go down to his house.
David said to Uriah.
When David heard that Uriah had not gone home. My translation is...
It's so different, it's confusing, isn't it?
I'll get the other one. I'll read out of this one for now.
Okay.
"Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?"
Uriah said to David,
"The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Judah dwell in... And my lord...
Joab.
The ark of Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing."
Then David said to Uriah,
"Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart."
So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next, and David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank, so that he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his couch with the servant of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote,
"So set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die."
And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite was slain also. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger,
"When you have finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger arises, and he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall?' Who killed Abim, Kalik, the son of Jerebessa? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone upon him from the wall, so that he died at Thebes? Why did you go so near the wall? Then you shall say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also.'"
So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent to him to tell. The messenger said to David,
"The men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also."
David said to the messenger,
"Thus shall you say to Joab, 'Do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack upon the city and overthrow it and encourage him.'"
When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she made lamentation for her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. And the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him,
Nathan is the prophet of the Lord.
"There were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him."
Then David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. Oh, and he said to David,
"As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing, and because he had no pity."
And Nathan said to David,
"You are the man."
Yeah, that's enough right there. We need to get to that part of this story where Nathan says to David, "You are the man." Nathan goes on explaining at some length of the evil that David has done. And let's take it up again at verse 13.
David said to Nathan,
"I have sinned against the Lord."
And Nathan said to David,
"The Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. Nevertheless, because by this deed you have utterly scorned the Lord, the child that is born to you shall die."
Then Nathan went to his house. And the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bore to David, and it became sick. David therefore besought God for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night upon the ground. And the elders of his house stood beside him to raise him from the ground, but he would not, nor did he eat food with them. On the seventh day the child died, and the servants of David feared to tell him that the child was dead, for they said,
"Behold, while the child was yet alive, we spoke to him, and he did not listen to us. How then can we say to him, 'The child is dead'? He may do himself some harm."
But when David saw that his servants were whispering together, David perceived that the child was dead, and David said to his servants,
"Is the child dead?"
They said,
"He is dead."
Then David arose from the earth and washed and anointed himself and changed his clothes, and he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. He then went to his own house, and when he asked, they set food before him, and he ate. Then his servants said to him,
"What is this thing that you have done? You fasted and wept for the child while it was alive. But when the child died, you arose and ate food.
He said,
while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. For I said, who knows whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live? But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me.
Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went in to her and lay with her, and she bore a son, and he called his name Solomon. And the Lord loved him and sent a message by Nathan the prophet, so he called his name Jedidiah because of the Lord.
Okay, thank you. That's a lot already. I'm going to have a stop here, talk about this section, and then read the other stories in which Bathsheba figures in a major way in a minute. How do you like David? This is the glorious king of Israel, the one like whom they hoped the Messiah would be, you know. What do you find out about David from these stories?
He's very human.
What do you mean by human?
Subject to all the desires and whims and wishes and so on that every human is.
Yeah.
And in this particular case, not terribly strong in his own character.
Yeah.
Perhaps a little spoiled by the fact that he's been king and has had everything that he's wanted at his beck and call. And
right.
Here's one thing he couldn't have just that way.
Well, he manages to get Bathsheba too, because he's the king and he can order armies around. Yeah.
The contrast is so interesting between Uriah the Hittite and King David. Uriah is the one who is more a model for a Messiah in the story, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He's such a good soldier. David isn't out with his army fighting.
Yeah, you know, at the very outset of the story, the time when kings go out to battle. However, David remained at Jerusalem, sent everybody else out to battle. Yeah.
And then I suppose important background for this too is that when a soldier is fighting, it was a law in Israel that he was not to have sexual relations with a woman. And so that's why David is having intercourse with this other man's wife who's fighting his battle while the man and his army is out fighting.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many ironies here.
Yeah.
And then he brings Uriah back, and time and again he tempts Uriah with his wife, and Uriah just is so righteous and faithful, and David just sinks deeper and deeper into this evil that he's plotting.
Yeah. You all understand what David has done to Uriah after he invites him to Jerusalem and says, go on down to your house, because Bathsheba has told him she's pregnant and he wants Uriah to sleep with her so that Uriah will think it's his child. Uriah refuses to do this because a good soldier won't do that. So David gets him drunk the next night and sends him off. He still won't go home. He does the right thing that a soldier does. And so what's the next thing that David does? He decides to have him killed at the battle. And sends the letter in Uriah's own hand. And Uriah, of course, doesn't read it. He just brings it like the good soldier he is. And David's captain is willing to do this. So he, and you see that he's obviously embarrassed about what's happened. He's brought his soldiers into a dangerous position. Some of the people who are close to David have been killed. And so when he sends the messenger back, he says, tell him what happened, but just make sure you tell him that Uriah the Hittite is also dead. And David's reaction to that is maybe the low point in this story. I don't know, but the message comes back and David says to the messenger, say this to Joab, don't let this matter trouble you. That's how it goes in warfare. Some people are going to get killed. Just go back and fight harder. And, well, anyway, excuse me.
It doesn't specifically say that Joab followed David's instructions to the letter about sending Uriah out in front and then falling back from him.
Oh, yeah.
He simply put him in a place where the fighting was very fierce and
that's true.
He would be very likely to be killed.
Right.
That he couldn't even perhaps bring himself to be quite that crass.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that observation. He didn't, it doesn't say that he withdrew all the other troops from around him. Yeah, he couldn't bring himself maybe to do that.
Well, in fact, it mentions he put Uriah in the place where he knew there were valiant men.
Yeah.
Who might not just fall back and leave him there.
I took that to mean valiant men in the opposition.
Oh, I see.
But,
And women. It's interesting that did not a woman throw an upper millstone on Abimelech, on Jerubbaal, and kill him? He got them so close to the wall that even the women could get the soldiers. It just shows how close he got, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting detail.
I thought that part right there tries to negate any influence that David might have had, because that was a confusing passage to me, but he says if the king gets angry, as if the king is going to say, now why did you do such a stupid thing, when in fact that's what he wanted all along.
So right.
He's really dug himself in, you call him just human, he's absolutely evil.
Yeah.
And plots to not only get him killed, but then to get himself completely out of any blame.
Mm-hmm.
In my reading this, that was the worst part of David's worst action, if I read it right. So I guess I'm asking that question.
So
is that right, what goes on there?
Say again what...
Well, in verse 20,
yeah.
If the king gets mad, and he says, how come you went so near the city? Didn't you know that you weren't supposed to do that?
Mm-hmm.
As if to say, I knew better than that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm clean in this whole thing. You were so stupid as to do that.
Right. What's happening here is that Joab figures that the king might get angry about the action that Joab has taken. And it suggests to me that he feels foolish as a commander for having done the thing that he did. And so if the report goes back and David either forgets what he's ordered Joab to do or pretends that he didn't know why Joab did it, then just make sure you tell him Uriah the Hittite is dead. But this isn't David actually speaking, but it's Joab. It's Joab imagining what David would say, and he does.
Right.
He does imagine that David would pretend to have no part of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to towards the beginning where Bathsheba is being identified. We know she's married to a Hittite. We know Hittites are not Hebrews. They have a long association, but they're very separate in terms of religion. And
mm-hmm.
She's identified as the daughter of Eliam.
Eliam, yeah.
Now, is Eliam a Hebrew? What I'm saying is...
No, no. Yeah.
We don't know that, but I'm just wondering if David would have been would have decided to take the wife of one of his other captains.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow that maybe he didn't think, at least when he started getting into this, that maybe this is maybe not quite as much of a sin, or this is not bad, but...
Well, I think that's relevant, that he sends to find out who it is. He finds out it's the wife of Uriah the Hittite, and then he has her brought over to sleep with him. Maybe the Hittite is attached to this man's name throughout. It suggests that may be relevant, maybe a racist thing, kind of a willingness of David to sacrifice him. And
was Uriah perhaps a mercenary?
He was definitely a mercenary.
And so it didn't seem
My notes in my texts suggest that the Hittites had a fairly long-standing relationship with the Hebrews.
Was upset with her first son Esau for marrying a Hittite.
Yeah.
And she was worried that Jacob was going to marry a Hittite.
Right.
So it goes back.
It goes way back.
Way back.
But I suppose, so I regarded him as acting like another Hebrew citizen, you know, being in the role of a citizen in the army rather than a mercenary. But the army, I guess I don't know the answer to that.
And another thing here, I was kind of wondering now when Joab says about David becoming angry, he sends back this report that they have attempted an attack rather than just sitting and besieging the city, and he probably lost other men too.
Mm-hmm.
And David's saying, now this obviously must have been a previous battle. Remember what happened at Thebes.
Right.
They got so close that a woman threw a millstone down and killed Elimelech.
Right.
Not in this city.
Right.
And so he has to report these perhaps heavy losses. And then he's saying, you know, David's likely going to get angry about that. But
right.
Just quietly remind him again that Uriah's dead. That will calm him down.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is one of the low points in the history of David, followed by the accusation by Nathan. A wonderful story, just tremendous example of the way the law is sometimes comes to us. That we hear about people doing wrong, we hear about sin, we hear about people breaking the laws of God, and we're saying, yes, that's terrible what these people have done, and suddenly we find that we're describing ourselves. And this is what happens to David in this exchange with Nathan. To David's credit, when Nathan puts it to him that way, he recognizes what he's done, and he says, "I have sinned against the Lord." You probably, some of you will know that Psalm 51 has traditionally been associated with this event. I'm just going to read you the heading of Psalm 51. This is a psalm, very well known psalm in the church. It's often read, the whole of it's a fairly long psalm, and a psalm of confession.
O God, according to your steadfast love, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. I know my transgressions, and so on. Create in me a clean heart, O God, comes from this psalm. At any rate, it's often said on Ash Wednesday, the beginning of the season of Lent and penitence. It's often said again in Holy Week. And the heading of it is a Psalm of David when the prophet Nathan came to him after he had gone into Bathsheba. So traditionally, that psalm of confession and penitence is ascribed to, attributed to David at this time. And so we can say that to his credit. Nathan responds to him, "Now the Lord has put away your sin, you shall not die," which would be possibly what he might expect, having killed a man. He might deserve to die himself, according to one standard at any rate. But the child that is born to you shall die. Then we get this next episode in which we see a completely different aspect of David, and I find him rather appealing in this section where he mourns. He is praying and hoping that maybe God will relent from this punishment and will allow his child to live. And finally, when the child dies, he needs to get on with his life, and the servants are surprised that he's not lamenting more now, but he was lamenting his sin and hoping that God would, God's forgiveness would include saving the child. When it's too late, he says, "Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." Very moving words that echo for me often when I think of the death of a child. Well, these are sections. Are comments you want to make about David in that section? Yes.
I think David, with his sleeping on the ground and fasting and praying, was a lot more hoping that God would reward his fasting and his praying than it was actually the beginning of grief.
Hmm.
Because if you're beginning to grieve when you're about to lose someone, there's always a sharper grief when they finally go.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, it was, well, there's no more chance to get God to change his mind anymore. Yeah. So I may as well eat, drink, and be married.
Right. So you see it as kind of cynical attempt to manipulate God. Okay.
A continuation of getting up to that point rather than beginning of the real penitence.
That sounds pretty true to character, but I was reading it more as a time of penance. So it was just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he change when the child died? You get less penitent.
Well, the pain could be in seeing that child die. This is his mother, probably. In seeing that child dying, there may have been a lot of pain involved in that. And the very fact that he rose from the earth, he washed, he anointed himself, he changed his clothes, and he went to pray. It sounds like a transformation to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I reacted to that.
Worshiping was also seeking God's mercy, and since we can't understand the true will of God in any circumstance, he is saying, who knows whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live.
Mm-hmm.
But now that he's gone, I can't bring him back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It isn't the grief.
It isn't the grief process for the child. It's a pleading with God to save a child's life. And so I think one, especially given the history of David, one is tempted to question his sincerity. But I think you could see it as sincere repentance, maybe aided by the context of Psalm 51, if one regards that as the work of David too. Since you mentioned that verse, Bathsheba is called David's wife, his wife Bathsheba there. Previously in this section, she is called the wife of Uriah the Hittite, the woman, the wife of Uriah, at verse 15, long after Uriah is dead, the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bore to David. I mean, she's not Uriah, she's David's wife, according to the story, but still called Uriah's wife at that point. But at this point, after the this process that David has gone through, when he comes in to console her, she's called his wife, Bathsheba. In this text we're about to read that occur years later, she's no longer called Uriah's wife. But she is in Matthew's genealogy, and it's an interesting emphasis on how she will be named here. Also, in this section, she has only one thing to say in the whole section: I am with child. Otherwise, she's kind of used, you know, she's in the background or she's manipulated by David. We're going to see a different person when we look at these other passages, and we better read them or we won't get to them.
So,
yeah, and I don't know the history there. He's called Solomon most of the time here. I don't know what that refers to. Nathan seems to have named him Jedediah, but David named him Solomon. So maybe it's his middle name. It's his baptismal name. Excuse me for introducing irrelevant. Okay. 1 Kings 1, starting at 11. We'll have the same readers. We'll just read 11 to 21, and then we'll jump to the other section, too. So 1, 11 to 21.
Then Nathan said to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon.
Oh, say, excuse me, I've got to say a little about what's happened here. David's much older. He's very old, in fact, and the question of who will succeed to the throne has come up. And he's had one son, very popular son by the name of Absalom, who decided he was going to be king, and he set up away from Jerusalem with lots of following and soldiers, and started a rebellion against his own father. And so David sent the soldiers out, but said, please be merciful to Absalom. And David's own soldiers fight this battle. Absalom is caught in a tree while he's riding underneath the branches of a tree. His head or his hair get caught in the branches, and he's hanging there. And somebody finds him and comes running back to Joab and says, Absalom is hanging in this tree. And Joab, the captain of David's men, says, why didn't you kill him? And he said, you heard what David said. He said, you know, don't, you know, treat him kindly. And Joab goes out and drives three spears through Absalom, and they bury him deep in a pit. And after that, the word comes back to David, and he says, oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son, if only it could have been me instead of you. And Joab, the captain of all David's men, says, you're making fools out of your whole army. We've gone out there and risked our lives to save you from this traitor, and you're weeping more over him than you would over the death of your entire army. And so David has to temper his grief. Again, you know, one of those very interesting episodes in this history of this man who could be a brutal and evil person, and very, at the same time, very compassionate and passionate about his own children, at any rate. Absalom is dead. Amnon, another son, is dead, killed by Absalom. And here's the third son, Adonijah. Adonijah is the heir apparent, and he decides he is going to inherit the throne and begin celebrating. He invites some of the dignitaries to his celebration, sort of his inaugural. And at that point, Nathan, who doesn't, who thinks that God has chosen Solomon, knows that God has chosen Solomon, decides more action has to be taken. We start at verse 11.
Have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king, and David our Lord does not know it? Now therefore come, let me give you counsel, that you may save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go in at once to King David and say to him, did you not, my lord the king, swear to your maidservant, saying, Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon my throne? Why then is Adonijah king? Then while you are still speaking with the king, I also will come in after you and confirm your words.
So Bathsheba went to the king into his chamber. Now the king was very old, and Abishai, the Shunammite, was ministering to the king.
Let me interrupt for a second. Abishai, the Shunammite, is a young woman described in the first part of this chapter. David in his old age was cold all the time, and they sent out to find a beautiful young woman who could come in to be with him, to keep him warm. So she's the latest in the harem, I suppose, who is keeping David warm.
Bathsheba bowed and did obeisance to the king, and the king said,
what do you desire?
She said to him,
my lord, you swore to your maidservant by the Lord your God, saying, Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon my throne. And now, behold, Adonijah is king. Although you, my lord the king, do not know it, he has sacrificed oxen, fatlings, and sheep in abundance, and has invited all the sons of the king, Abiathar the priest, and Joab the commander of your army. But Solomon your servant he has not invited. And now, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are upon you, to tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise it will come to pass, when my lord the king sleeps with his fathers, that I and my son Solomon will be counted offenders.
Okay. We will be counted offenders. Why is that? Because Solomon is a threat to the throne. That God has appointed, Nathan has appointed Solomon as the heir. Adonijah, some people feel, should be the heir. He's older. Solomon's too young, for one thing. And if the eldest son should be the king, then it would be Adonijah. So this is normal palace intrigue. Normal, it's what we read about in the plays of Shakespeare all the time in England, brother killing brother, people being threatened by the possibility that somebody else might think they could become king. And in fact, in this situation, Adonijah is establishing his claim to the throne by inviting the captain of the guards who is supporting him and this other priest. But there are those, including Nathan, who support Solomon, and Nathan decides, now's the time, we better move. We better make a move here, or this isn't gonna happen the way God intends it. So, this is Bathsheba's plea here to David, and David's response is to order that Solomon be anointed king immediately, and they have their own anointing ceremony. It's going on almost simultaneous to Adonijah's ceremony, and the result is that Solomon does get a foot in first and is established as king. Let's jump ahead and read the other section and we'll talk about both of them. That's chapter 2, starting at verse 13. I think we'll read 13 to 25.
Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and she said,
"Do you come peaceably?"
He said, "Peaceably." Then he said, "I have something to say to you." She said,
"Say on."
He said, "You know that the kingdom was mine, and that all Israel fully expected me to reign. However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. And now I have one request to make of you. Do not refuse me." She said to him,
"Say on."
And he said, "Perhaps King Solomon, he will not refuse you to give me Abishai and Shunammite as my wife." Bathsheba said,
"Very well, I will speak for you to the king."
So Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him on behalf of Adonijah. And the king rose to meet her and bowed down to her. Then he sat on his throne and had a seat brought for the king's mother. And she sat on his right. Then she said,
"I have one small request to make of you. Do not refuse me."
And the king said to her,
"Make your request, my mother, for I will not refuse you."
She said,
"Let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah, your brother, as his wife."
King Solomon answered his mother,
"And why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom also, for he is my elder brother, and on his side are Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah."
Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying,
"God, do so to me and more also if this word does not cost Adonijah his life. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and placed me on the throne of David my father, and who has made me a house, as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death this day."
So King Solomon sent Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, and struck him down, and he died.
Okay. These are the only other episode, only other places in Scripture where we see Bathsheba. In her later age, she talks a lot more. She's got a different kind of influence in the court. And you wanted to say something?
No, I'm just leaving back.
Okay, all right. This last segment is rather curious, here's my assessment of it. This is pressing it a little bit, and we have to try to understand what's going on in the court. When I look at the, I think of Adonijah as a threat to Bathsheba and Solomon. She just managed barely to get David before he died to work it so that Solomon would beat out Adonijah for the throne. Adonijah, though he knew that Solomon had been chosen by the Lord, was still trying to ace him out somehow for it. So here comes the same Adonijah a little bit later with a request. How does Bathsheba feel about Adonijah? It's not clear. Why would he come to her? Also not clear. He doesn't go straight to Solomon, but she asks, "Do you come peaceably?" There's some question here. Now, whether he might be carrying a sword in his pocket. And he says peaceably, okay, she's willing to talk with him. What she says is, go on. Say on, I think your translation has it. And he makes this, leads up to this one request, and she says, say on. Please ask King Solomon to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife. Now, she was part of the harem of David. And according to their practice, the harem of the king, just like all the other possessions of the king, are inherited by the next king. So she belongs to Solomon. And there are two episodes earlier in this story of the monarchy in which the harem of the king figures. One of them is when Absalom is trying to overthrow his father, and he's got a counselor, Ahithophel, who is regarded as a very wise counselor. And this counselor says, now that you've taken over Jerusalem, David leaves Jerusalem and retreats, and Absalom has taken over the city. And he says, what should I do now? He says, sleep with all of David's concubines. This will show to the people that you have taken over as king. And so he does it publicly in the sight of the people, so that somehow this action is an action that demonstrates that he has taken over the role of king. That's important background to this. When Adonijah asks for one of the concubines, the wives of Solomon, it may be regarded as an act of treason to be sleeping with this woman who is the wife of the king. It may be a way of establishing his claim to the throne. As curious as that seems to us. But so Bathsheba says, in response to his request, very well, I will speak to the king on your behalf. What tone? You know, how enthusiastic is Bathsheba about this? It's hard to tell. But she goes to the king, and he says, make your request. She says, I have one small request to make of you. Do not refuse me. Standard thing you say, do not refuse me. And he says, okay. And here's her request. Let Abishag the Shunammite be given to your brother Adonijah as his wife. That's all she says. It seems to be there. She seems to be doing what Adonijah asked her to do, but with what enthusiasm. Knowing that this might be regarded as an act of treason to sleep with this woman, and that's how Solomon reacts. He's angry. Might as well give him the kingdom. It's somehow linked to who rules the kingdom. Might as well give him the kingdom, and he's got this priest Abiathar and Joab on his side. My translation says, ask not only for him, but also for the priest and for Joab. That is, this would be giving power to that whole party. And therefore, he decides it is an act of treason and it deserves death, and he sends this man off to kill him. I think that Bathsheba is pleased with the results. I don't think she's making a genuine plea. When she makes a genuine plea, we see how she does it in the previous chapter, when Nathan says, plea for yourself, for your son to be made king. Nathan puts a lot of words in her mouth in chapter 1 here. Tell him these things. Didn't you swear to me, saying your son Solomon shall succeed me as king? And when she goes to David to speak, she says at least twice as much as Nathan tells her to say.
She elaborates on this, and she does a nice job of it and persuades David. But in this case, when she's asked to plead for Adonijah, she says the bare minimum. And I think in both cases, she's very persuasive according to what results she wants, and she gets the results she wants.
So in this interpretation, by agreeing with Adonijah to, you know, to make this plea on his behalf, he goes out thinking that everything's going to be okay, or the, you know, the worst that's going to come out of it is a no.
Right.
And so he's put off his guard, and she goes, and basically through this plea puts Solomon either even more on guard to the threat of Adonijah, and Solomon dispatches Adonijah and his party.
Mm-hmm. Right. I my editor here, they don't usually make strong editorial leanings if they're not sure. But in this case, they've just making a case here. They say an excuse is found to eliminate Adonijah. That's how they regard this little passage. An excuse is found. These editors think that that's what's going on. Solomon needed an excuse, and maybe Bathsheba knew that that's how this would work. Maybe she didn't, but.
Well, I think in a way Adonijah does himself in with this request, and Bathsheba knows it. So she doesn't have to say more, perhaps. And this is another way to look at it, that he's grasping for power. And the minute she hears this, she knows he's done for. He's out of here.
Yeah.
All Solomon has to know is this information.
Right.
And he's going to kill him. So she does that. The other interesting thing, is how it's set up in verse 13. Then Adonijah, son of Haggith, that's his mother, came to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. And you can think in a harem, all the intrigue, they all have the same father, but they've got different mothers. And so the naming of the mothers here is interesting,
right.
And kind of introduces some tension there too, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, is she going to plead for this other woman's son as over against her own? Not likely. It's wonderful how understated these biblical stories are and leave us needing to read carefully to understand the underlying emotions and this kind of intrigue that's taking place. I do want to again mention the contrast between the Bathsheba in the earlier stories and the Bathsheba here. She comes to David went to plea for Solomon, not as somebody that he's passionate about sexually anymore. He's got Abishag the Shunammite in there. And it's mentioned in the text. She's right there in the room. But she comes in and she's learned the ways of the palace and how to exercise her power, and she does very effectively, and perhaps also in this place too. Now, those of you who are here, that when we looked at Tamar and Rahab, see a completely different kind of woman here, I think. When we looked at those women, and maybe some of you could just mention some of the contrasting qualities. I'll start out and see what you come up with. But they seemed very independent. They were initiating actions. They were in charge of things. Very much independent operators, and not nearly as much governed by their relationship to men as Bathsheba is. But given that she is a wife and a mother in the court where she's working with royalty, the people who run the whole country, she has, within the range of possibilities. She has a great deal of influence, and she learns how to exercise it. Why would she be included in the genealogy of the great ones of Israel, leading up to the Messiah? And why would she be named the wife of Uriah there?
Well, one of them would be because he had so many wives that he wouldn't know who he was out of. And another one would be that it was such a significant point in David, if it was the whole point in David's life.
Yeah, I think that's certainly... Both may be significant, because the other sons of the other wives of David figure importantly in the history too.
Solomon, though, it was recognized as such a wise and wonderful king,
mm-hmm.
and she after all was his mother.
Yeah.
And so because the line comes down through Solomon.
Right.
She gets credit at least.
Yeah.
For being his mother.
Right. So, and that's another relevant point. She was the mother of Solomon, the wise king. But being called the wife of Uriah suggests that what our attention is drawn to is the episode with David and the low point in David's career. And that one of the curious things about this history of Israel that we've seen repeatedly, both in looking at the Joseph story and these stories, is that these people have not whitewashed their history, and they have not edited out the rough edges and the seamy side of things. But in fact, they're constantly reminding themselves, they're raising up these stories of the outsiders, of marginalized people, reminders of this low point in David's history. Otherwise, there's no need to call her the wife of Uriah, but it's always a reminder that David took somebody else's wife.